the Dharma, incomplete, profound, and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 6 of the 7-day session here at Turtleback Zendo in March 2017 in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And we are, as we said before, by the time we start Taisho, we're already well through a good chunk of the day. So it's not only a few hours left of day 6, and then we are in the final day of Sesshin. Energy has been good throughout the Sesshin, which is excellent. It seems always to be really strong here, which is a real credit to the folks here. I'd like to share with you today the story of Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi was a near contemporary sage. In fact, Kapila Roshi met him and also met his wife, Kapila Roshi's wife, at Ramana Maharshi's ashram in India when Kapila Roshi was on a pilgrimage from training in Japan in quite a long time ago at this point. Both of them are long gone. They were both so impressed by Ramana Maharshi that when they had a daughter, they named her Ramana. Eventually, she went with her mother's later Hindu teacher, and he gave her a different name, which she ended up changing legally, and she is known now as Sudarshana Kaplo. But Ramana Maharshi, his story is another one like that of Flora Courtois and Jacques Le Savant, both of whom had deep awakening experiences without having any context within to place it. In other words, neither of them knew of Buddhism. I doubt that Ramana Maharshi also knew of Buddhism because it was long gone from India, except at intellectual levels. It's now back in India, thanks to the efforts of some Japanese Zen Buddhists and other Buddhist priests who went to India to carry on the work of an untouchable Dalit sect person named whose last name was Ambedkar, who converted to Buddhism because it did not accept the Hindu separation of people into different categories, of which the Dalit were the bottom, and Ambedkar was a Dalit man, although he managed to get through college and actually I think he ended up with a high political position. But at any rate, Flora Courtois, of course, had a deep awakening experience after some years of searching deeply, increasingly deeply, for a truth that would always be true regardless of circumstances. She had the culmination of this when she was in college at the University of Michigan, when everything broke open for her, and as she wrote, the earth changed on its axis, and her life was forever changed after that. She was fortunate enough eventually to come into contact with Buddhism, and a Buddhist teacher who happened to be Miyazumi. Back then he was Miyazumi Sensei, and became eventually Miyazumi Roshi and the head of ZCLA, Zen Center Los Angeles. Prior to that, he was a Soto teacher who actually shared some lineage with Kapila Roshi, because he also studied with a Yasutani Roshi, and therefore was able to teach koans in the traditional manner. And so people who come out of ZCLA are usually well experienced in working on koans. But Flora actually went through the entire koan curriculum with Mayazumi, and he eventually asked her to teach, which she declined. She ended up I think by the time she had met Mayazumi, she was already the mother of a son, married and the mother of a son. Her husband, actually, I think her husband's name was Jacques Courtois, and I think their son may also be Jacques Courtois. But at any rate, all of that is pretty much irrelevant. The main point is that she persisted in this deep questioning, which really caught her attention until she had the results. And as for Jacques Le Seran, he chose finally to drop his ideas of what he needed to have to feel happy, to feel safe, to feel secure when he was incarcerated in the notorious concentration camp Buchenwald during the Second World War. He was a very young man. I think he was 19 years old when the group that he helped to found, one cell of it was betrayed. And they were rounded up, 21, 22 guys. Actually, there may have been women among them as well. And put into prison and eventually taken to Buchenwald, where it was beyond comprehension in terms of abuse, terror. I won't go into the details, there's no need to. I think we have heard enough about how it might have been for people in the concentration camps during the Second World War, where death was everywhere, and eventually, of course, Jacques Le Seran did become deathly ill, seriously deathly ill. And his body was shutting down. So he let go of what he needed to have in order to be happy. And that's a key point in awakening for anyone, is letting go. And what we're letting go of is this self-image. Sometimes it's termed ego. And ego is a little bit different. Self-image comes born of conditioning and our assumptions around that conditioning. We have experiences and we are conditioned by those experiences, but we also draw conclusions about ourselves as a result of those experiences. And that those conclusions about ourselves bring forth a self-image that then we feel compelled to defend, uphold, and it brings us to act in ways that we might not find effective, ideal, happiness-producing, so on and so forth. But they all come out of this assumption that we are a certain kind of person. And he let go of that. So did Ramana Maharshi. It's all going to happen to us as we die. We can no longer hang on to this person that we think we are at the moment of our death. And it's rather interesting. There are books written about people in the last months, weeks, days of dying, and how for many of them there's the possibility of transformation. There's one story I remember well, and that is about a young man. I don't know what he was dying of, possibly AIDS, but he was bitter, unpleasant, and that was how he had been actually during his active life before he got sick. Very difficult to get around, very difficult to be in the company of. And he stayed that way until think it was the last 36 hours of his life, and suddenly he completely transformed, did a total about face, and became caring, compassionate, open, loving, embracing others, not being so self-absorbed. And so, when he died, he was able to die in peace. And that's a key, because if we die attached to our self-image, it's not going to be a happy journey or a pleasant journey. It's going to be difficult and painful and frightening. And so, Shiro Bunan, whose name literally means the great way is not difficult, Shido, the great way, Munan, not difficult, his teacher gave him that name, and he was the grandfather in Zen of Hakuin. He wrote, if you die before you die, you won't die when you die. You die before you die, you won't die when you die. Now, he's not suggesting that people become zombies or shut down and dissociate and travel numbly through the rest of their lives. He is saying if you let go this image of who you think you are, then life flows because you'll be able to connect with that flow. And you will no longer have any fear of dying. However, that fear of dying can actually come up before one has let go. And it's pretty classic in Zen to have anxiety at the least, and fear possibly as well, come up at a certain stage of our practice. What to do about this? Is to tune in to the physical experience of that sense. And that's exactly what Ramana Maharshi did. I'd like to share with you now, in his own words, his experience. And this, a number of books of his teachings were written, including at least one that has this account in it, but at this point we're taking it out of a book called The Enlightened Mind, an anthology of sacred prose, edited by Stephen Mitchell. There's a little bit of a note here in the appendix on Ramana Maharshi, who was born in 1879 and died in 1950 of cancer, by the way. It says, Maharshi means great sage. He was well known for treating all visitors with equal courtesy, whether they were squirrels or maharajas. Gandhi used to send burnt out followers of his to Maharshi for spiritual refreshment. His enlightenment experience occurred when he was 16 years old. He was sent to live with an uncle in a different city in order to advance his education, because there was a school there that was more appropriate or higher level or whatever. It doesn't really go into the details for him to go to instead of whatever school he was at, which may only have gone up to a certain point where he was living with his parents. By that time, his older brother was already gone. But anyway, here are his words. About 6 weeks before I left Madura for good, the great change in my life took place. It was quite sudden. I was sitting alone in a room on the first floor of my uncle's house. I was rarely sick, and on that day there was nothing wrong with my health, but I was seized by a sudden, violent fear of death. There was nothing in my state of health to account for it, and I didn't try to account for it or to find out whether there was any reason for that fear. In another place, he wrote that there was nobody in his family who was sick or or ready to die. He didn't know anybody who was in that condition. I just felt, quote, I am going to die, close quote, which of course we all are going to do, and began thinking what to do about it. It didn't occur to me to consult a doctor or my elders or friends. I felt that I had to solve the problem myself there and then, and this is also a key. Nobody else can practice for us. Centuries ago, Seppo and Ganto were traveling together. And Ganto, who was younger than Seppo, already had had a deep awakening experience and eventually went on to teach. And as they're traveling together, Seppo when they stop, he sits down and starts doing Zazen. And this occurred frequently enough that Ganto said, you know, what are you doing? And he said, I need to practice because I need to come to awakening. And then Seppo really was in tears about this because it had been years that he'd been working on his practice and still didn't see any seeming progress. And he said, can't you help me with this? And Ganto said, I will do what I can, but there are four things that I cannot do for you or for anyone else. I can't eat for you, I can't sleep for you, I can't pee for you, and I can't shit for you, and I can't come to awakening for you. Eventually, Seppo did come to awakening and lived a long, productive life teaching. Ganto, on the other hand, died rather young at the hands of bandits and violently. It is said that when he was run through by a sword, or however they killed him, in Japan they say they chopped off his head, but it's hard to know exactly what exactly happened because we don't have access to that, at least not here. And as he was dying, probably more like run through the sword, because he screamed so loud that it was heard 3 leagues away. That's 9 miles away. Somebody heard him scream. This was a cause of great distress to Hakuin when he heard this, because he thought, if somebody as great as Ganto can scream when he dies, what hope have I got for not falling into hell? At any rate, eventually, Hakuin had a deep enough insight that he laughed out loud and said, ha! Ganto is alive and well right here now. Ganto lived centuries before Hakuin. So to continue with Ramana Maharshi's tale, there was nothing in my state of health to account for it, and I didn't try to account for it or try to find out whether there was any reason for the fear. I just felt, I'm going to die, and began thinking what to do about it. It didn't occur to me to consult a doctor or my elders or friends. I felt that I had to solve the problem myself there and then. The shock of the fear of death drove my mind inward, and I said to myself mentally, without actually speaking the words, now, death has come. What does it mean? What is it that is dying? This body is dying. And I at once dramatized the occurrence of death. I lay down with my limbs stretched out stiff as though rigor mortis had set in, and imitated a corpse so as to give greater reality to the inquiry. I held my breath, kept my lips tightly closed so that no sound could escape, so that neither the word I nor any other word could be uttered. Well then, I said to myself, this body is dead. It will be carried stiff to the burning ground and there burnt and reduced to ashes. But with the death of this body, am I dead? Is this body I? It's silent and inert, but I feel the full force of my personality and even the voice of the I within me, apart from it. So I'm spirit transcending the body. The body dies, but the spirit that transcends it cannot be touched by death. That means I am the deathless spirit. All this was not dull thought. It flashed through me vividly as living truth. I perceived it directly, almost without thought process. I was something very real, the only real thing about my present state, and all the conscious activity connected with my body was centered on that I. From that moment onward, the I, or self with a capital S, focused attention on itself by a powerful fascination. Fear of death had vanished at once and forever. Absorption in the self, again with a capital S, continued unbroken from that time on. This is the essential self, the Buddha nature, the true self. Other thoughts might come and go like the various notes of music, but the I continued like the monotone Shruti note that underlies and blends with all other notes. Whether the body was engaged in talking, reading, or anything else, I was still centered on I. We don't want to assume that it's centered on some self-image, because at that point there was no self-image. This I that he's speaking of is beyond self-image. It encompasses all things and yet nothing at the same time. This is our true nature. Previous to that crisis, I had no clear perception of myself, again, capital S. I was not consciously attracted to it. I felt no perceptible or direct interest in it, much less any inclination to dwell permanently in it. And he went on to sit in profound meditation for weeks afterwards, in samadhi, we would call it. Initially, he was sitting outdoors, and local kids were pelting him with stones, trying to get some kind of rise out of him. So then he went down into the basement of an abandoned building and sat there. And eventually along came somebody else who discovered him and took it upon himself to take care of him, to keep the kids away, to provide him with shelter, with nourishment, with water. And then eventually he went into the hills, and a gathering grew up around him, the ashram. And when he lay dying, it was so profoundly peaceful. Even though he was in great pain, and the only sign he gave, his students gathered around him and began singing, and a single tear came out of his eyes, along with this incredibly loving gaze, and he breathed his last breath. I'd like to share some of his teachings. Affection toward the good, compassion toward the helpless, happiness in doing good deeds, and forgiveness toward the wicked. All such things are natural characteristics of the Master, with a capital M. Elsewhere he writes, we loosely talk of self-realization, again that's capital S, self, for lack of a better term, but how can one realize or make real that which alone is real? All we need to do is give up our habit of regarding as real that which is unreal. All religious practices are meant solely to help us do this. When we stop regarding the unreal as real, then reality alone will remain and we will be that. And how do we reach that? With this extended out-breath, we become increasingly aware of where we are caught in unreality, where we're caught in a self-image that demands defense, validation, and as a result can get us into all kinds of pain and suffering. As we do this practice, seeing where we're caught enables us, little by little, if we tune in and don't try look the other way, to let go the habit pattern of its ongoingness. And little by little, I guess you could call it fogginess, the obscuration at least, of our true nature begins to thin out, and we begin to get deeper glimpses. And one day we get a deep enough glimpse that we're able to work on subsequent koans, which purpose is to expand and deepen that initially open. And of course, we don't stop there, because these habit patterns can be tenacious, and they can continue to drive our behavior unless we actually work on shifting the behavior to open to these negative habit patterns or pain-producing habit patterns. Is not enough, but it's major, and it's essential to being able to let them go. A long time ago, and for many years, I hugged this to my chest. Kepler used to have any student that had a Kensho experience write him a letter and describe it. And then sometimes he'd read these letters at the end of Taisho, never giving out the name. And there was one that appeared in one of the early Zenbo issues, which, as I said, I hugged to my chest because it gave me hope when hope was exceedingly dim. The person that wrote this story, actually account, it wasn't a story, wrote that she entered a sesshin where she ended up having the Kensho experience. And as she entered the Zendo, she felt like she had to nail herself to the mat because she wanted to flee. That was my experience for years. And during the day sesshin was going to begin that night of, I would not dare go outside the Zen Center, not even to the backyard, which was all fenced in. And, you know, you had to go through a gate to get out. I just was so afraid that if I went outdoors, I'd flee, I'd leave, and this was my only hope left to become free of suffering. Everything else I had depended on had crashed, and I had realized not long before the crash, thankfully, that there would never be anything outside myself that would provide me with lasting happiness. Temporary happiness, how long? A few hours, a few days, not longer than that. And then the other shoe would drop. The only thing that would give me lasting happiness would be to go inside. And I didn't even know what I was going inside for. At any rate, this woman wrote that she had to virtually nail herself to the mat in order to stay in the Zendo. And she went through all kinds of difficult mind states during the sesshin. And then, sixth or seventh day, I don't remember which, I'm not sure she said actually, she had an opening that was deep enough that Roshi passed her on her koan. And she wrote afterwards, and this is significant, "This practice is truly bodhisattvic. First, it shows us where we're caught, and then it sets us free. First, it shows us where we're caught, and then it sets us free." And it's the being shown where we're caught that's not particularly comfortable. We don't like to see that we might not have been optimal, compassionate, wise, caring in our behavior, in our speech. And yet if we haven't been, and we've had moments of whatever, attachment showing, then it's going to eventually, if we are willing to persist and willing to be open to what the practice can reveal to us, it's going to show us these things. And there lies the possibility, right there, because we can see it, of letting it go. Of course, it may come back again, but it won't have the strength that it had initially. It may come back one more time or two more times as well, but again, each time the strength of that habit pattern is diminished. And neuroscience backs this up as well. Because if we don't continue to act on the synaptic connections in our brain that couple behaviors, then they kind of die on the vine. The connections get weaker and we're less compelled to act on them. And eventually they simply die out. And at the same time, what practice reveals to us is our increasing compassion. It's not our increasing compassion. The compassion was there. It's that we are able to activate it and live out of it more and more completely. This is the incredible gift of our practice. It means sticking it out. It means, for most people, working with a teacher who's been there before us and understands the path, knows and can see in us when we're moving in the direction that's not going to work so well. Because it's so easy to delude ourselves. The world is full of self-proclaimed teachers who think they've had some kind of insight and haven't really, and do more damage than good. Often they do a great deal of damage, which is sad. I think there's a little bit more we can share from Ramana Maharshi's teachings. "The ultimate truth is so simple. It is nothing more than being in the pristine state. This is all that need be said. All religions have come into existence because people want something elaborate and attractive and puzzling. Each religion is complex, and each sect in each religion has its own adherents and antagonists. For example, an ordinary Christian will not be satisfied unless he's told that God is somewhere in the far-off heavens, not to be reached by us unaided. Christ alone knew him, and Christ alone can guide us. Worship Christ and be saved. If he's told the simple truth that, quote, the kingdom of heaven is within you, quote, close quote, which of course are the words of Jesus, he is not satisfied and will read complex and far-fetched meanings into such statements. Only mature minds can grasp the simple truth in all its nakedness." And then there's another statement he made. "Reality is simply the loss of the ego." And again here, it's not the ego in a psychological sense. It's the ego in terms of the self-image, which can drive the ego too, but self-image, we need an ego to be healthy, but the self-image can get in the way. Destroy the ego, and I would say, really, I think we should substitute self-image for this term. Destroy the self-image by seeking its identity. And this is exactly what extending the out-breath does. We're exploring our own mind. We don't usually pay much attention to our mind. Thoughts, sure, and thoughts often drive us. But what's the reality beneath the thoughts? This is what we want to open to. And this is what we can open to through this miraculous extended out-breath. Destroy, I think I have an argument with that word too. Let go the self-image by seeking its identity. It will automatically vanish and reality will shine forth by itself. This is the direct method. There is no greater mystery than this, that we keep seeking reality, though in fact we are reality. We think there's something hiding reality, that it must be destroyed before reality is gained. How ridiculous. A day will dawn when you will laugh at it, all your past efforts. That which will be on the day you laugh is also here and now. The eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. When we can open to the truth of this, and we realize with great joy that we are all things. And this doesn't put us in some exalted state of mind. That's important to recognize. This puts us squarely on our feet with the ground under us. With our ideas not given such amazing importance as they usually are, we're able to drop deeper into a kind of knowing which will guide us. It's an inner sense that says, do this. And it's accessible only beyond words. And when we do go in concert with it, everything turns out right. And if this means becoming a political activist, it will guide us in how to be that political activist to the very best and most effective way. If it means becoming a Zen monk, it'll guide us in that direction as well. If it means whatever it means, it will guide us in that direction. I have two major examples in my life where I listened to that still small voice, if you want to call it that. And one of those was fairly early on when I was living outside the United States and had already come to Sesshin once and realized, because after I got back to where I was living, I couldn't bring myself to even go in the room where the mat and cushion were for 3 weeks afterwards. That despite the fact that all I cared about with that first Sesshin, which was a 4-day, was surviving the schedule. The awakening, forget that. I just cared that I could manage the schedule. And yet, despite the struggle, I had all 4 days, the morning after Sesshin, in the Zendo there, sitting informally, I sat for 2 hours without realizing it. And yet, when I got back to where I was living, outside the country. I couldn't face even the room where the mat and the cushion were. So I realized that I needed some external impetus to continue practicing, because I already knew that that was the only way to free myself from suffering. And back then there was tremendous suffering. And so without knowing whether I would be accepted in Rochester, whether I could find work, so I aimed at going on staff, which meant being able to live and practice at the center, because there I would be required to sit. Otherwise, I wouldn't be allowed to stay there. I didn't know if I'd be accepted, and as it turned out, I moved there in November, just in time for November Sesshin, my first 7-day, and it was not until the following August that I was allowed to come on staff. So there were quite a few months there where I had to make ends meet somehow or other. Back then we had the, what we called Sangha houses, because everybody was young and single. They were all in their 20s, I was in my early 30s. And so it was possible to rent a room in a Sangha house for $12 a month. I could manage that. And I went to all the training programs I could afford to go to at the Rochester Zen Center. And I went to all the sittings as well. And eventually I was allowed to come on staff. It just still was not easy. Even 2 years later, some of us went on, during the staff break, we drove out to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and had a wonderful time there for a week and then drove back. By the time we got to the southern border of Pennsylvania, and you have to go all the way up to the northern border of Pennsylvania and all the way up to the Great Lakes in New York after that to get to the Rochester Zen Center, it was many hours of driving, yet the panic hit right at the southern border of Pennsylvania. If I hadn't realized that there was no alternative, unless I wanted to be totally miserable the whole rest of my life, I wouldn't have stuck it out. But eventually it was very clear that it was worth it. Very clear that it was worth it. And so now you can see why that account of that person's Sesshin, in which she had a Kensho experience, was so important to me. Not everybody has those anxieties, fears, but in my case, the conditioning was so strong that that's what was there. We all have the potential for awakening. We all have the potential for deep awakening. And that's why we're sitting here right now on day 6 of this Sesshin, because we have a sense of that. And it's true. We can have freedom. And that freedom is beyond anything we can even imagine. I won't tell you the other major reason that I followed my deep sense, but perhaps another time. I think that's enough for now. I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.